It gives me great pleasure to welcome two young scholars who are based here at the Isu Prasad Center for Caribbean Studies. So we are staying at home. Unfortunately, Anjali couldn't make it, so we've just got two speakers this morning. First of all, I'd like to introduce Malachi McIntosh, who is a final year PhD student here, and he is currently working on a thesis on the representation of the Caribbean by migrant authors from the region. He writes fiction and criticism, and his work has been published in The Guardian as well as in the Journal of Romance Studies. So it gives me great pleasure to ask Malachi to present his paper. He will speak for 20 minutes, and then Michael will speak for 20 minutes. So.
Over to me. Okay. First and foremost, thank you very much for having me. It's quite a major life event for me being here at this conference because it's the first time, despite being my final year of my PhD, that I'll be presenting in front of a specialist audience, which comes with all of its own sort of anxieties, which are multiplied by anxieties which were brought to the forefront a moment ago when Professor Birbal Singh came to me after the last presentation and said, you know, you realize you're the only sort of African person here, right? I was like, oh yes, I realized that quite a long time ago. So there's that. And the additional trepidation added to you by the fact that throughout the composition of the thesis that this is a portion of my supervisor has constantly told me, oh, this is really controversial. I wonder what a Caribbean specialist audience would make of this. Oh, I don't think they'd like this bit, and with some sort of sadistic glee. So it will be interesting, to see how you all respond to what I have to say. So we'll see how it goes. So the title of the paper is Naipaul's Truth and Laming's Truth, Representation and the Immigrant Author, and it will be a comparison of the two authors named in the title, but we'll get to that. So we'll start out with Naipaul. Oops, hopefully. Fantastic. So there he is in all his glory. So readings of V.S. Naipaul often grant the author a kind of mythic singularity. His background as the first major and most well-known Indo-Caribbean writer, coupled with his piquant, provocative, and almost parodic nonfiction, combined to create an image of the author as unique in his attitudes and in his perspectives. Unfortunately, what is often forgotten in Naipaulian readings are the facts that, and they should come up. Firstly, the content of Naipaul's work changed dramatically over the course of his career. Secondly, that Naipaul's singular status is as much a product of his reception as it is of the content of his work. And thirdly, that Naipaul did not arrive in England alone. Now, the third point is perhaps the most important, and it forms the foundation of the argument that I'll be advancing today. The argument is simply that V.S. Naipaul, despite quite frequent readings of him and reviews of him and things, his works and depictions of the Caribbean are not quite as singular as we often take them to be. So, as everyone in this audience probably knows, the critics of Naipaul's work often gloss over, the author was but one of a huge cohort of immigrant intellectuals from colonial regions to Europe after the Second World War, from the Caribbean and elsewhere. Like his contemporaries, Naipaul benefited, almost paradoxically, from metropolitan concern about immigration, which fed both racist responses and marked spikes in writing about the colonies. Around the time of Naipaul's arrival in England, historians, novelists, and newspaper reporters were all called upon or nominated themselves to sate the desires of the public by explaining what was occurring and had occurred to create the colonial decline. While many writers already based in the metropolis benefited from this increased interest, so sort of native or indigenous English writers and things like this, you could say, arguably no writers benefited more from this increased interest than those who had immigrated from the Anglophone Caribbean. And I say that off the back of Kenneth Ramchand's study of the West Indian novel and its background, where he says that in the sort of 15-year span from the end of World War II to sort of when immigration changed and the number of Caribbean immigrants coming here really contracted, that 85 novels were published by Anglophone Caribbean authors in the UK, and that's far more than any other sort of colonial space and people from elsewhere. So, as in other contexts, Naipaul and his peers fulfilled an essential function. They represented their people to themselves and also to the outside world. their spokesmen, organic intellectuals in the Gramscian sense, representatives of a newly recognized social group who give it homogeneity and awareness of its own function, not only in the economic, but also in the social and political field. So they served a role of sort of solidifying an identity. While the attractions of a metropolitan writing life drove huge number of hopefuls from the West Indians to England in search of literary success, only a handful can be said to have truly fulfilled the role of the region's organic representatives. Naipaul, of course, would be one of these. And of the authors who arrived in England in the half decade after the war, only two can be said to have achieved the influence necessary to be seen as real spokesmen and Naipaul's peers in a more than chronological sense. These would be his fellow Trinidadian and Indo-Caribbean Sam Selvon, and also the Barbadian George Lamming. Like other authors from the same location, all three of these novelists' earliest reviewers afforded their work value based on their verisimilitude. But, as evidence of the role of the Caribbean's voices, this trend has continued with modern academics who have praised the faithfulness of these authors' fictions to Caribbean facts. Contemporary critics have lauded Naipaul's rendition of the realities of society in late colonial newly independent state, as a quote, Lamming's ability to portray, another quote, how the West Indian sees himself, and Selvon's, final quote, realistic depictions of peasant life. In Naipaul's case, of course, praise for the truth of his fiction has not gone unchallenged. Critics have extensively highlighted various issues with taking his writing, even his nonfiction, as real, transparent depictions of postcolonial territories. In a manner similar to Naipaul's many challengers, Rob Nixon has noted the author is seen as, quote, a Mandarin possessing a penetrating, analytical understanding of third world societies. But, among other things, he was, another quote, schooled to perceive the immediate world of Trinidad as paradoxically remote and insubstantial, as exiled to the margins of an English-centered reality. Nixon here is signaling two common problems that are flagged by many of Naipaul's sort of staunchest critics. The first is a problem of according him an acute or uniquely acute vision when viewing postcolonial societies. The second linked problem is the idea that because of the way Naipaul was brought up and the fact that he attained the status as a Mandarin, that this would necessarily create a gap between himself and the people that he represented. Now, what basically Nixon is criticizing here and what most of Naipaul's critics have an issue with is this idea of Naipaul's habitus. Now, habitus is a concept kind of coined by Pierre Bourdieu, the French sociologist, and it's depicted up here on this slide. So the idea of habitus is that the way you're brought up creates a certain social position. Your social position, which is more than just your class, it's also your actual context, will influence the way you see the world. The way you see the world will influence your actions will therefore influence your position, and so on. So the critics of Naipaul say that because of the way he was raised, because of the fact that he's an immigrant, because of the fact that he has been afforded this very unique status, Nobel Prize winner, etc., he cannot possibly perceive the colonial world in the way that a colonial resident would. And that's fair enough. Now, let's see. Now, as mentioned, as I said, this is a common critical approach to Naipaul's work, one put forward by as many detractors, and one that often draws upon his Indo-Caribbean background to add to arguments about his distance from the people he portrays. And yet, despite this frequent approach to Naipaul to destabilize the putative truths of his writing, what is rarely acknowledged is the fact that the author's subject position was not vastly removed from that of his contemporaries. While neither Selvon nor Lamming ascended to Naipaul's heights within the colonial education system, it would be a fallacy to say that either wrote from a habitus that was identical to that of the people they presented, and arguably no author writes from a habitus that's identical to the people they present. All three authors produced their major works from a position outside of, and as far as relationships of relative power are concerned, this is a controversial bit, above the rest of the Caribbean. Nonetheless, because of the nature of the publishing world and the role they played within it, and wider, as organic representatives, Naipaul, Lamming, and Selvon all positioned themselves in such a way that their qualifications to portray the truth of the Caribbean experience, to fulfill this representative role, was not questioned. Of the three, Lamming's immigration-inflected habitus is least frequently analyzed in considerations of his work, and through his many nonfiction essays, it's the position he himself sort of frequently denied as a substantial influence on his perspective. Nowhere are Lamming's attempts to position more evident and sustained than in his 1960 book, The Pleasures of Exile. This book was published at the peak of Lamming's career, after four novels that dealt directly with the Caribbean experience at home and abroad. It's a collection of essays that reads in parts like a concerted attempt to assert a status aligned with the Caribbean peasantry, specifically the Caribbean peasantry, not just the people. In fact, within the book, Lemming scathingly criticizes the work of some of his contemporaries, including Naipaul, for the failure to identify with Caribbean peasants. By attacking authors who did not occupy this particular peasant social position, Lemming, whose work in 1960 had been tightly focused on peasants and the underclass, takes a clear position and puts himself forward as a true representative of the Caribbean experience. He reinforces this by saying that all West Indian authors have, quote, peasant sensibilities, that all West Indian novels have peasant substance, peasant motives, and peasant directions. And, of course, because these comments accompany sort of his criticism of the likes of Naipaul, he is saying that that only novels like his own, which are focused on peasants and quite exalting of the peasant experience, are really representative of what the Caribbean is all about. However, I would argue that Lemming was no more a peasant than V.S. Naipaul. The author was, before his departure from the Caribbean, an important figure in Caribbean letters. In England, he had regular and substantial work, including appearances on Caribbean Voices, production roles for the BBC's Overseas Service. Even if he was not in a position of influence in Britain, another controversial bit, his life and ideas would still be far removed from the realities of the Caribbean peasantry he sought to represent. It is important to stress that, although Lemming and his contemporaries were born, grew, and were educated in the Caribbean, that to emigrate means to immigrate together with one's history, traditions, ways of living, feeling, acting, and thinking, and that immigration itself is an integral part of that history. That's actually a quotation from Abdelmanek Sayed. It's important to my argument and the bit that my supervisor says is controversial, because the idea is that once you are an immigrant, just the mere experience of immigration separates you from your people. You cannot be considered a direct representative anymore. So, in other words, although a significant portion of an immigrant's identity is formed before their departure, the very act of immigration will influence their habitus and alter their perception even before they come to occupy, as they will inevitably, new social positions within their new place of residence. While many critics have acknowledged the sort of gulf between Lemming's social and physical positions and his self-positioning, rather than challenging that claim, most of them just note a problem, such as, and this is quite common in post-colonial criticism, we cannot take this person's words at face value because they're not necessarily of the people they're talking about. And then they move on and then essentially take the person's words at face value, even though they're not from the place they're talking about. Like Naipaul, Lemming's work is everywhere stained with evidence of his non-peasant perspective, however. Nowhere is this more jarring than in Lemming's most directly peasant first novel, In the Castle of My Skin. While the novel is quite clearly occupied with the problems faced by the Barbadian underclass and evidences a revolutionary drive for peasant autonomy, its depictions on close inspection reveal the ambivalence and the actual social position of their author and a close kinship, and also show a close kinship with Naipaul's first novel, Miguel Street. So the remainder of this presentation will be a comparison of the two novels, how they sort of evidence a similar perspective. So the similarities between the two novels are striking. Both In the Castle of My Skin and Miguel Street tell two stories simultaneously, the story of a young male narrator who grows up and grows away from a small community, and the story of the community itself. Where Naipaul's unnamed narrator eventually moves away from the eponymous Miguel Street to find his fortune abroad, so too does Lemming's main character, named G, who by the end of the novel has grown from a timid boy to an anxious man, ready to leave behind his village called Creighton's Village. Like Naipaul's novel, in simple numerical terms, the community surrounding the main character receives the bulk of the narrative's focus. The lives of the peasants, their routines, their habits, their quarrels, their questions, are considered on far more pages than G's thoughts and experiences. Also like Miguel Street, the lives of the people depicted are shown to be rich, eventful, and, because of the time period in which both novels are set, overdetermined by their status as colonial subjects. So the colonial relationship is central to the novels. Now, this is where critical considerations kind of split on both of these. Generally, critics say that this colonial relationship in Lemming's work is more evident and more conflictual. And the idea in the books, or the idea is that within Lemming's work, he is very actively critical of the colonial situation. On the other hand, for Naipaul, most critics will say that Naipaul is sort of showing that the people are as much at fault for what they're doing wrong as the sort of colonial power, as it were. And in fact, we kind of do see that within the novels. In The Castle of My Skin, it's made very clear that what's going wrong with the people is a result of their oppression, while in Miguel Street, things are slightly different. Nonetheless, I would argue again that beneath this sort of top-level consideration, there lies something altogether different. Though there's an imbalance in the number of pages in the novel that focus on villagers' lives and G's life in The Cast of My Skin, there's a similar imbalance in the representation of G, the main character, and of the peasant masses, one that becomes steadily more jarring as the text progresses, and one that has clear parallels with Naipaul's novel. Specifically, G, in The Cast of My Skin, is accorded a dynamism and a drive that is wholly absent from those around him. In the novel, villagers are largely presented as ignorant, impotent, and incapable of change. And in fact, this is a theme that runs through a lot of first-generation Caribbean writing, Francophone and Anglophone. They're consistently lumped together, mostly referred to simply as the boy, the woman, the man. Lemming has explained this away with a comment that, and I quote, "We are rarely in the novel concerned with the exploration of an individual consciousness." And while this is true, the extreme contrast between the vicissitudes and the development of the named individual consciousness, when we're concerned with it, and the stagnation and decay of the largely anonymous collective privileges the individual with an intelligence, agency, and potential that the collective simply are not given. Miguel Street, Naipaul's novel, is very similar. In it, the unnamed narrator, the sole perspective, is situated as an intermediary between the people he portrays and the reader. He is positioned in like manner to the emigrant author's actual social position, almost as a prism through which this experience is filtered. He's an intermediary between the reader and the people represented. He's inarguably privileged. He speaks with the authority of one with intimate connection to all the workings of his island. He frequently makes blanket statements, such as, "There's no stupid pride among Trinidad craftsmen. No one is a specialist," which show his overarching understanding of everyone in Trinidad, not just those on Miguel Street, despite the narrator in this book being quite a young man. Though he is of the island, poor enough to not be of the class of people to wear pajamas to bed, a quotation from the book, he is still very much superior to the people whose lives he describes. He's literate, where many in the novel are not. His concise narrative tone marks him from the outset as more articulate than his Creole-speaking neighbors, and he completes intellectual tasks without any difficulty. In both Castle and Miguel Street, the ignorance of the people is directly linked to impotence and a lack of dynamism. In Lamming's novel, school children conspire to attack their head teacher for revenge, but decide not to do it. The head teacher himself discovers his wife has been cheating on him with one of his employees, but he's unable to approach the offender because he felt, quote, "a strange impotence of action." And after that episode, he goes on a long riff about how the people weren't capable of doing anything, not just himself. The extent of the masses' impotence is portrayed in a riot scene at the center of the book. After an extended strike period in the nearest city, riots break out and rioters spread toward the village where the novel is set. The villagers are scared, but find it difficult to act, this is a quote, since everything depended on the fighting in the city, which no one had seen. Eventually, the rioters arrive, stalking the colonial landlord, but at the last minute, they decide that they're incapable of striking him. Similar impotence can be seen throughout Miguel Street. Notoriously, in many critical readings, anyone on Miguel Street who makes a plan and seeks to complete it does not, except for the narrator. Each chapter tells of another character's failures, failures which range from the starkly tragic to the simply foolish. A character named Bogart tries to flee the street but is forced back. Popo never finishes the things he builds and gets arrested for theft. George, inveterate wife beater, dies. Bigfoot wants to be a champion boxer, but he's beaten up and afraid of dogs, and etc. As stated by Bruce King in the novel, nothing is made, no business succeeds, no artwork is finished, no love or marriage lasts. Things are much the same in Lamming's novel. In The Castle of My Skin, the villagers live repetitive lives. They have no power to change anything, especially the things that need to be altered in order for them to survive. This is all unlike G. G, the main character, is one of only two dynamic characters in the entire novel, and the other is his childhood friend, Trumper. Both of them are eventual immigrants. Because Trumper leaves for America very early on in the novel, only to return at the end, we're presented solely with G's development and his alteration throughout the book. Like Naipaul's narrator, the difference between G's ongoing growth and the ruin of his village is glaring. There's no greater symbol of his ability to move while others stagnate than his preparation for flight from his home island in the novel's final chapter. While this is happening, so while he's preparing his things to immigrate, his fellow villagers are forcefully uprooted by land developers, their town is destroyed, but G has the power and the dynamism again to kind of move himself. In both Miguel Street and in The Cast of My Skin, emigration is presented as the only real option for intelligent and self-motivated main characters. In Miguel Street, after the collapse of the local community, when the neighborhood leader is arrested, the narrator's life falls into a rut. Eventually, his mother criticizes him and organizes a way for the narrator to immigrate and escape the inevitable ruin of life on the island. Though we know the narrator is in a position above the people he spends the novel among, for all the reasons I've presented, his departure is portrayed as somewhat joyless. As he waits for the plane, he's frightened. The foreigners waiting there looked too rich, too comfortable, and he wants to put off the moment of being with them. In Laeming's novel, kind of paradoxically based on its reception by critics, immigration is presented far more positively. G's immigrated friend Trumper returns to Creighton's village for a visit on the eve of G's departure. Preceding his reappearance, Trumper's beneficial metamorphosis abroad is forecasted in the letters he sends to G. The letters are, quote, written in a way I hadn't thought him capable of and which I didn't quite understand. He had been away 3 years and a new place had done something to him. He had learnt a new word and the word seemed like some other world which I had never heard of. Trumper had changed. When Trumper appears in person, his voice is deeper, he is big, confident, and self-satisfied, and he looks happy and prosperous. So his flight to America has not only improved him intellectually, through the letters as we've seen, he also makes physical gains. So his whole person has improved. Where immigration is represented as an ambivalent necessity that forces disconnection in Miguel Street, in Castle it is wholly beneficial and shown paradoxically as creating a closer bond with those people left behind. Trumper says that by leaving he has learned more about his people and race and that none of you here on this island know what it means to find race. As the two characters speak, they stroll through a town stripped bare by developers, making it clear what fate awaits those who remain. The knowledge, ability, and skills the people need to halt their destruction simply are not available in their own environment. The self-consciousness and empowering race consciousness presented as Trumper's main gains from his journey are only accessible abroad. In the Castle of My Skin tends to be read solely as an anti-colonial critique, while Miguel Street is read as one in a series of Nepalian misrepresentations of the colonial situation. In truth, neither characterization is accurate. While there's a fixation on the presentation of the truth in readings of both Laeming and Naipaul, it's clear that the truths that both authors present are truths that are refracted through their own experience as immigrants. Immigrants in the process of reconceptualizing their relationship with the lands of their birth. Immigrants who are privileged representatives of Caribbean life. The ambivalence of this positioning and its doubling in the dual elevation and denigration of rural peasants found in Laeming and Naipaul's novels deserves further exploration and wider application to other Caribbean and postcolonial immigrant authors. Thank you.